The talk that I'm going to share with you today is a kind of overview of a book that I've been working on for a number of years now, which has given birth to a few spin-off articles. So if you're familiar with some of the things that I've published on fascism, it might overlap with some of the things that I present in the talk. The title of the book is Fascism and the Socialist Solution. And I just kind of like to walk you through some of the basic arguments. And then towards the end, I will share some of the ways in which this framing of fascism and its historical development can provide us with tools for understanding the contemporary moment, and in particular, the situation in places like Ukraine and Palestine. So the first kind of conceptual intervention in this book is a critique of what I refer to as the ideology of fascist exceptionalism. The Holocaust industry has played no small part in the process of presenting fascism as an absolutely singular phenomenon that appeared perhaps only once or twice in history, was ultimately defeated by the Western democracies, and therefore fascism is not something that is systemic to capitalism, but an exception to it. This, moreover, is presented as the kind of dominant ideology, or at least the liberal ideology concerning fascism, in a world in which there's only one country that has been responsible for overthrowing more than 50 foreign governments since World War II, or at least attempting to overthrow them, been involved in innumerable assassination attempts against the leaders of various governments, and in a minimum has its intelligence service that killed 6 million people between 1947 and 1987, all the while propping up dictatorships and running death squads around the world. And so this logic of fascist exceptionalism, of course, runs cover for the greatest imperial power in the world today, and that is the United States. So a lot of my work engages with fascism as a very important site of what I would call conceptual class struggle, meaning that the very concept of fascism is an important reference point for the struggles between different and rival ideologies. And in that regard, I don't think it makes sense to assume that fascism has some type of eternal essence that's been baked into it that we could define for all time. Instead, it is a site both of conceptual and practical struggle, and that for my research in the book, the most coherent approach to fascism is a dialectical approach. I mean a number of things by that that will come out through the course of my presentation, but one of them is that, as Lenin famously claimed, the world is so complex that its processes surpass human comprehension, and that any of the concepts that we establish in order to try to latch onto those complex processes are of necessity limited in their scope. Therefore, with the concept of fascism, I think that it is very helpful with this dialectical approach to distinguish between at least three different levels of analysis in what we can call a kind of multi-scalar dialectical analysis. The first level of analysis is the most common within bourgeois approaches to fascism. It is the conjunctural level of analysis. The conjunctural level looks at a specific place and a particular time, such as Italy and Germany in the interwar period. In that regard, it is important to highlight, and I'll get on to the other two levels in a second, that fascism did not emerge within this conjuncture as a coherent ideology or a fixed set of ideas. Mussolini himself said, quote, "Fascism was not the nursling of a doctrine previously drafted at a desk. It was born of the need of action and was action. It was not a party, but in the first 2 years, an anti-party and a movement," right? So fascism as a concept became kind of consolidated within the Italian context, but it emerged out of an anti-working class movement that was quite inchoate and didn't have a consolidated ideology in a rigorous sense of the term. A few important aspects of that conjunctural emergence of fascism is, of course, the threat of the socialist alternative, which appeared on the world stage in 1917 with the Russian Revolution, and then was seconded by the fact that the capitalist world was soon thereafter, in the 1930s, rocked by the Great Depression. And so the conjunctural fascism that we see in places like Italy and Germany, as well as in Japan in the East, is in part an attempt on the part of the bourgeois state to develop a more radical form of authoritarian governance that could mobilize at least certain segments of the masses in the era of mass-administered democracies. In that regard, these fascist endeavors relied extensively on mass communication and propaganda to target those sectors of civil society like the petty bourgeoisie, as well as certain elements of the lumpen proletariat and the proletariat, but with the backing of the industrial capitalists, and I'll touch on this a little bit more in a moment, but the capitalist backing of these fascist movements is integral to understand them, and that backing was then further supported by a kind of nationalist and colonial ideology of radical transformation in order to crush the workers' movement and launch wars of conquest. So at this conjunctural level of analysis, I think one of the best definitions, at least operative definitions of fascism, is that put forth by Michael Parenti in his work, Black Shirts and Reds. He said that fascism is nothing more than a final solution to the class struggle, the totalistic submergence and exploitation of democratic forces for the benefit and profit of higher financial circles. Fascism is a false revolution, right? It promises a radical transformation of society, but what it delivers is actually an ongoing war on working people. The second level of analysis that is important is a structural level of analysis. And this you often don't find within the bourgeois theories of fascism. A structural analysis doesn't simply look at particular spaces and times, such as Germany and Italy, but it instead examines specific phases of capitalist accumulation. And if you look at this level, meaning a structural analysis of capitalist countries in the interwar period, one thing that you find, and Martin Kitchen has published pointedly on precisely this topic, is that in every single capitalist country, in the wake of the Great Depression, you had major fascist movements, right? And so the connection between fascism and capitalism therefore becomes much more apparent at this structural level, and it cannot simply be attributed, as the bourgeois concept of fascism often does, to the cultural particularities of Germany or of Italy, because one thing that the bourgeois concept of fascism does is it largely describes fascism as a cultural phenomenon, as a superstructural phenomenon, and it doesn't mine down into the economic base. People like Jason Stanley or the other most famous theorists of fascism in the contemporary bourgeois world, of course, traffic precisely in these modalities of thinking. The third level that I think is important is a systemic level of analysis. So the historical materialist approach to this kind of a multi-scalar analysis looks at the social totality and examines the ways in which the conjunctural developments of fascism in Italy, Germany, and Japan are nested within a larger structural development of the fascist movement in a moment of capitalist decline and socialist resurgence. But all of that has to be situated within the larger historical social totality of the systemic development of the capitalist world system. In this regard, in the work of Marx and Engels, there was already an identification of the ways in which capitalism, in order to accumulate, relies on extremely repressive forms of parastate and state violence in order to basically prime the capitalist pump, if you will, in what Marx referred to it as so-called primitive accumulation, of course, a term that he borrows from bourgeois political economy. So Marx wrote that capital came into this world dripping from head to toe from every pore with blood and dirt. It came into the world through acts of brutal, genocidal colonialism, through the enslavement of major swaths of the population, the indigenous population, the African population, and that this colonial heritage needs to be understood as the forms of violent imposition of a capitalist system that predated the conceptual identification of fascism per se, but that resonate very strongly with some of the fundamental impulses that are integral to understanding what fascism is. And the systemic level of analysis that connects fascism to colonialism and the deep history of colonialism also allows us to see the ways in which the real struggle against fascism needs to be a struggle against colonialism. And it foregrounds the extent to which all three of the major fascist countries that are identified as the main forces in World War II, Italy, Germany, and Japan, were invested absolutely and totally in colonial endeavors. And so the colonialism that predated, you know, that predates fascism as a concept needs to also be understood as one of the driving mechanisms behind fascism, even in its conjunctural sense. As I'm sure a lot of the viewers and listeners know, the Nazi rampage in the East against the Soviet Union was actually modeled on the US colonial rampage in the West and the Western frontier. And just as the US settlers were genocidally eliminating the indigenous population in order to have living room to the West, so were the Nazis planning on genocidally eliminating the peoples to the East in order to open up their Lebensraum or living realm in the East. And this is a very, very explicit connection. And Germany was simply one of the countries like Italy, and Japan is a little bit of a different case for various reasons, mainly contextual within Asia. But they were the latecomers to the colonial feast, and they wanted to catch up with the great Western imperialist powers and even surpass them. And they certainly surpassed them in the colonial appetite, even though they didn't fully succeed. In this regard, this multi-scalar analysis of fascism allows us to overcome the bourgeois concept of fascism and the ideology of fascist exceptionalism that I alluded to briefly before. I think that many people who are familiar with Marxist analysis are very attuned to the ways in which bourgeois ideology often passes a particular off for a universal. So that when the founding fathers of the United States claimed that all men are created equal, what they did not mean was that all people were actually created equal. What they meant is a particular group of white property-owning males were created equal. So they take the particular and they talk in the name of the universal, right? As if that was all people. What's interesting in the ideology of fascist exceptionalism is that rather than universalizing the particular, this ideological operation transforms the systemic into the sporadic, the structural into the singular, the conjunctural into the idiosyncratic. So it's the same basic ideological move, but in the opposite direction. It is the natural outgrowth of this bourgeois approach to fascism that conceptualizes Germano-Italian fascism as absolutely unique and defines it in terms of its epiphenomenal and superficial characteristics and never mines down into the capitalist roots, thereby obfuscating the structural parallels with other forms of repressive governance around the world and also in deep history. Moreover, this ideology of fascist exceptionalism more or less excludes materialist analyses and the use of the term fascism in certain other cases by trying to maintain the idea that fascism was something that was just integral to particular cultures at specific times. This approach, I think, is problematic because it reduces the extent to which fascism is a product of the capitalist system, and that the way in which it historically emerged is not simply in opposition to modalities of bourgeois parliamentarian rule, but often hand in glove with them. It's often claimed within the bourgeois concept of fascism that the way that you fight fascism is that you defend liberal democracy. And at a certain level, I think it's very important from a Marxist vantage point to defend the gains of liberal democracies insofar as they at least purportedly maintain some zone for the rule of law, for a certain respect of human rights, for voter rights and things like this. And that we should not only maintain any that they have, but we should marshal all of our power to expand them as much as possible. So the argument that I'm making is not a kind of ultra-left argument in which you just say, well, liberalism and fascism are the same thing, and we should just burn them both to the ground. No, they're not the same thing. But very importantly, and this is where my argument is headed, I think it's essential to recognize that liberalism and fascism are both modes of capitalist governance. And that if we seriously understand the material history of liberalism, we have to recognize the ways in which it has often worked hand in glove with fascists, empowered them, and allowed them to operate precisely because they often function as the bad cop of capitalism to liberalism's good cop. And so to refer back to what I just mentioned about pushing back against any kind of ultra-leftist confusion, I think that it's very good to have a good cop as opposed to a bad cop if we're talking about who's in control of state power. But at the same time, the whole goal of the good cop, bad cop interrogation routine is to confuse those being interrogated and make them believe that salvation lies with the good cop of capitalism, not with the abolition of the entire system of the good cop and bad cop, or the kind of hegemonic rule and repressive rule, but overthrowing capitalism in the name of socialism. In that regard, if we look at the history of liberal governance, one thing that we need to recognize is that it is often collaborated with the rise of fascism. And we see this within the conjunctural form that fascism took in the interwar period. In October of 1922, it was magnates in the Confederation of Industry and major bank leaders that provided Mussolini with the millions of dollars necessary for the March on Rome in a kind of spectacular show of force. But Mussolini did not seize power. Instead, and Daniel Guérin has highlighted this quite poignantly in his book, Fascism and Big Business, that I recommend, Mussolini was summoned by the king on October 29th of that year and was, according to parliamentary norms, entrusted with forming a new cabinet. The capitalist state thereby turned itself over without a fight, but Mussolini was intent on forming an absolute majority in parliament with the help of the liberals. So it was the liberals who supported his new electoral law in July 1923, and then they made a joint slate with the fascists for the election on April 6, 1924. The fascists, who had only had 35 seats in parliament, gained 286 seats thanks to the help of the liberals. The case of Hitler is somewhat similar in two aspects. One is that they both received capitalist banking, both from national capital and from international capital, particularly US capital, and it was the liberals who aided and abetted his rise. So Hitler claimed in a famous speech on October 19th, 1935, that he had the material resources necessary for supporting 1,000 Nazi orators with their own cars, who could make some 100,000 public meetings in the course of a year. And all of this was due to his financial backers, the Ford family in the United States and other financial backers here, but also industrial capital in Germany. Prior to the election in Germany in the 30s, the Communist Party candidate Ernst Thälmann had argued that a vote for the conservative Field Marshal von Hindenburg amounted to a vote for Hitler and for war. And of course, after Hindenburg was elected, he invited Hitler to become chancellor. So fascism in both of these cases came to power through bourgeois parliamentary democracy, and they were bankrolled by big capital. And the candidates did the bidding of big capital while also creating a populist spectacle, a false revolution that marshaled or suggested some mass appeal. Of course, there were also activities that both the Italians and Germans were involved in that were extra parliamentary, that were illegal, et cetera, right? So it's not as if they only abided by the norms, but they did follow those norms within the kind of public spectacle of gaining power. After they gained power and consolidated it, this was quicker in the Nazi case than in the Italian case, they then did go much more full-on authoritarian. They became engaged in crushing organized labor, eradicating opposition parties, destroying independent publications, putting a halt to elections, scapegoating and eliminating the racialized underclasses, privatizing public assets, launching projects of colonial expansion, and investing heavily in a war economy beneficial to the industrial supporters. So it established a direct dictatorship of big capital. An important aspect of this analysis, of course, a lot of the bourgeois approaches to fascism are rather flat-footed, and they don't track out how fascism actually changed quite a bit in both Italy and Germany through the course of time, so much so that even the more left-wing elements within both Italy and Germany's fascist movements were cut off in order to consolidate this more authoritarian right wing as things evolved. It's also important within this larger context, of course, that the other purported liberal democracies of the West were not fighting fascism, right? The capitalist states refused to form an anti-fascist coalition with the Soviet Union, a country that 14 of them had invaded and occupied between 1918 and 1920. And during the Spanish Civil War, Western liberal democracies did not officially support left-leaning government that had been elected. Moreover, in 1934, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy signed the Munich Agreement, in which they agreed to allow Hitler to invade and colonize the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. So they gave him a green light to colonial fascism. And indeed, it was the fear of being left to confront Hitler alone, which eventually drove Stalin, since 1934, the unswerving champion of an alliance with the West against Hitler, into the Stalin-Ribbentrop Pact of August 39, which he hoped to keep the USSR out of war and buy him time for developing the productive forces as much as possible to defeat the Nazi war machine, which he, of course, and the other Soviets knew was coming. My reading on this particular agreement was that the pact was not a pact of somehow solidarity between the fascists and the communists. On the contrary, they were not allies. This was a very tactical decision because the Soviet leadership had been backed into a corner and they just needed to buy themselves time in order to build up their military and their defense capabilities. In this regard, the overall kind of depiction of conjunctural fascism needs to be written, and fortunately there's great work on this front, in terms of a capitalist backing and strong liberal aiding and abetting. I would like to point to the fact that the US backers of capitalism also included big capital within the United States, as well as some of the important forces that were operative within the US national security state. So Ford, General Motors, Standard Oil of New Jersey, and DuPont had all become deeply involved and invested in Germans' weapons production in the interwar period. And in fact, American investment in Germany had sharply increased after Hitler came to power. According to Christopher Simpson's excellent work on this front, Commerce Department reports show that the U.S. investment in Germany increased some 48.5% between 1929 and 1940, while declining sharply everywhere else in continental Europe, right? So in this regard, fascism in Europe was astroturfed. It wasn't simply a grassroots movement. And fascism, as far as I've been able to see in my research, I've not found examples of fascism that is purely grassroots. I've always found instances of astroturfing. Astroturfing, of course, means that instead of a grassroots movement coming from below, there are capitalist ruling class elements that plant the seeds by funding fascist movements and trying to foster them as much as possible. One of the important legal firms involved in foreign direct investment in Hitler's Germany was Sullivan and Cromwell, which of course was overseen by or part of the leadership of Sullivan and Cromwell was the Dulles brothers, who would go on to become the head of the U.S. State Department on the one hand and the head of the Central Intelligence Agency on the other. And they would make sure in the wake of World War II that these financial investments were protected. I'll just touch on this briefly in passing, but we should all know, of course, that fascism wasn't defeated by Western liberal democracies. It was defeated by the colossal sacrifice of approximately 27 million Soviets and approximately 20 million Chinese. The war against fascism was fought and won in the East. Only some 400,000 US Americans gave their lives to the war fighting against fascism. Of course, this pales in comparison to what the Red Army did, and the overwhelming bulk of the Nazi war machine was run in the East. In that regard, if we just stay for the time being on this conjunctural level of analysis and then attach it to the more structural level of analysis, I think that anyone who's educated within the imperial core generally affiliates fascism with Nazism and fascism perhaps in Italy, but they don't think about fascism within the US context. And so I'd like to just briefly outline some of my research on precisely that topic, because As I mentioned earlier, there were very important fascist movements in every capitalist country as of the late 20s, early 30s. And in the case of the United States, we came very close to a fascist coup d'etat. And in 1934, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, after weeks of investigation, concluded that, quote, certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country, end quote. The plot did eventually fail, but it was a plot to overthrow FDR's government, the New Deal government, and then to set up a dictatorship that would be fascist and that would be controlled by the capitalist ruling class of this country. I'll get into the specifics in a moment. This emerged out of an organization called the American Liberty League. Dimitrov, if you're familiar with his excellent analyses of fascism, claimed that in contradiction to German fascism, which acts under anti-constitutional slogans, American fascism tries to portray itself as the custodian of the Constitution and American democracy. So we have American exceptionalism, the freedom discourse, and all of this that's baked into the very name American Liberty League. There were a lot of other fascist movements in the States at the time, the Ku Klux Klan, the Sentinels of the Republic, the Crusaders, the Silver Legion of America, the German-American Boon, Friends of New Germany, the list goes on. These are the historical predecessors to the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, and the fascist organizations that we have operative today. Many of them also emerged directly out of the military establishment in various ways, a lot of impoverished veterans who became members of these organizations. In the case of the plot in the United States, which is referred to as the business plot, it's the Morgan interests, DuPont, Rockefeller, Pew, and Mellon that were the principal bankrollers behind this planned fascist coup d'etat. Of course, some of the most famous robber barons in the history of the world. And they worked with high-profile political figures in the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the party of slavery, that party, the party of mass incarceration, the party of genocide in Gaza, that were opposed to the New Deal and wanted to roll back the New Deal. In that regard, they made the plan to hire a man by the name of Gerald G. Maguire, who went on a four-month research tour of Europe to visit four different fascist countries and study which version of fascism would be the best one to implement in the United States. And he supported drawing on France's Croix de Feu movement, which is a fascist organization that was composed of some 500,000 commissioned and non-commissioned officers. And so it was drawing on the military and using veterans in order to then implement. Their plan was to implement Hitler's unemployment plan in the United States. Of course, that unemployment plan was so successful because it involved forced slave labor. Maguire then considered General Smedley Butler to be the ideal leader of the movement, although they were also considering Douglas MacArthur, Theodore Roosevelt Jr., and other commanders within the military. They were going to use the pretext of the president's ill health, this is FDR, so that then the president would become a figurehead like the King of Italy, and then the fascist leader could take control of the government. They were going to honeypot veterans into doing this, and they had arms via Remington arms secured by the DuPont interest because DuPont had a controlling shared interest in Remington arms. And they were going to pay the veterans a bonus from World War I that they were owed by the U.S. government, but the U.S. government kept refusing to pay. And so they were going to honeypot the veterans into marching on Washington. They had planned to only pay them 1 year. So it was obvious that they were just going to use them. They weren't going to pay the full bonus. They were going to use them until they got their fascist in office and then shift the government out of parliamentary elections and go full on fascist. This was not the only conspiracy that was revealed. There were others also that involved various conspirators, but it's the most well-known one. It's thanks to John L. Spivak, who was a communist journalist at the time, that he actually was able to get a hold of the full transcripts of the McCormick-Dickstein committee that weren't released to the public and weren't shared with journalists. And so we have all of the internal investigations that prove that this wasn't a conspiracy that people were thinking about. It was a conspiracy that they were acting on very, very concretely. The other element in this kind of counter history of fascism that I've been developing that I think is important is that the bourgeois idea of fascist exceptionalism often claims that fascism was defeated in World War II. I've done a long and detailed article on this. If anybody's interested, I'm just going to touch on a few of the highlights, called "The U.S. Did Not Defeat Fascism in World War II. It Discreetly Internationalized It." And we know from the history of the U.S. empire that it's always been opposed to socialism, and particularly hostile to Soviet-style socialism. And they were involved in trying to overthrow the USSR from 1918 to 1920, and then were involved in the blockade against it, etc. But it was not even the wake of World War II. It was during World War II that the U.S. national security state began working very closely with Nazis and Italian fascists, and later it would do the same with Japanese fascists, in order to integrate them into the U.S. national security state and into intelligence services around the world, in order to establish a veritable fascist international, in order to keep doing the important work of Hitler and Mussolini, and that was fighting the workers' movement. I'll just highlight a few aspects of this. Reinhard Gehlen, of course, was the head of the intelligence services of the Nazis. He was a general in the Third Reich against the Soviet Union in the wake of World War II. Instead of being put in prison as a war criminal, he was brought to the United States, taken to a Yankees game, met with all of the major architects of the U.S. national security state, and then put back in charge of the new democratic intelligence services of West Germany. And he proceeded to then hire thousands of the Nazis with whom he had been working in order to continue doing the purportedly important work, at least from the point of view of the national security state of the United States, in fighting communism in Germany and in the East more generally. Eric Lichtblau has estimated that some 4,000 Nazi agents were brought to the United States. Operation Sunrise was run in Italy, doing the same thing with members of the Italian fascist network, including very high commanders like Valerio Borghese, known as the Black Prince, often identified as being the leader of the neo-fascist movement in the wake of World War II, was protected by James Angleton and the OSS that became then the Central Intelligence Agency. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, the numbers that I said about Eric Lichtblau were incorrect. His estimates for how many were brought to the United States were 10,000. 4,000 was the number that he estimated of Nazis integrated into German intelligence services. We probably all are familiar with Operation Paperclip, that brought 1,600 Nazi scientists, Hitler's doctors of death, to the United States, provided them often with research funds, promises of American citizenship, hooked them up with U.S. universities. There were some 14 of some of the most prestigious universities in the country, including Cornell, MIT, and Yale, that participated in Operation Paperclip. They were also brought over with their families. And I'll also reference Operation Gladio, in which the CIA and MI6, the more or less CIA equivalent in Great Britain, set up secret stay-behind armies in every country in Western Europe, including neutral countries, that they proceeded to stock with Nazis and fascists in order to continue fighting a war of subversion against the East, and to be purportedly ready for a Soviet invasion of the West, and then they would run subversion campaigns against the communists. But they were mobilized in the strategy of tension, particularly in Italy, Germany, and Belgium, in order to commit acts of terrorism against the civilian population that were blamed on communists and socialists, so that they could be targeted for being rounded up and thrown in prison. This has all been extremely well documented at this point in time through the Italian courts that found that this was this conspiratorial organization that was not beholden to the liberal democracies of these countries. That was established in the early 1990s. The European Parliament has a resolution on it. And I would greatly recommend the documentary work of Alan Frankovich, both his film on company business on the Central Intelligence Agency and his film Gladio on the Stay Behind Armies actually has a lot of firsthand accounts of those involved in these enterprises talking about it rather candidly. In that regard, then, we have to understand that the bourgeois state in the imperial age does not simply function according to what the spectacle of politics dictates to the masses and via its corporate media reach. It also functions, importantly, driven by what Annie Lacouaris refers to as the men and women of the shadows, meaning that the invisible government, some people call it the deep state, the intelligence services, the national security state, or the more nefarious and hidden aspects of the national security state, often have done the opposite of what the spectacle of politics claims that it is doing. And one of the reasons for the U.S. national security state hiring so many fascists from Italy and Germany, and the same is true in the case of Japan, is precisely so that they could contribute to an international fascist network that they could use to fight against workers' movements around the world. I think that if we look at the contemporary moment, then one way of approaching current fascism is by breaking with the one state, one government paradigm, which is so widespread within liberal debates. It's the assumption that either a country is a democracy or it's fascist, and that there's no room for an analysis that would be a variegated analysis of degrees, for instance, or a dialectical analysis of different levels and forms or modes of governance within particular countries. What the one state, one government paradigm tends to foster then is the idea that, well, fascism is only a real threat if it takes over the government, and if it doesn't, then we don't have to be as concerned about it, or it's simply as a threat or something that creeps in or other things like that, not a reality that actually affects people's lives right now. Against that, I think that a dialectical approach to fascism has to embrace a multiple modes of governance model, meaning to take seriously the ways in which the capitalist ruling class manages the general population through different means at different points in time, and that part of that management is through the hegemonic work of the visible government and of the forces that are operative within the kind of spectacle of politics. But in the phase of imperialist capitalism, in which there is an increasing discrepancy between the very tiny ruling class and the amount of wealth that they own and control, and the masses of workers globally, there's an increasing reliance on other forms of governance that are often parastate forms of governance, so parallel to the state, and often engage in and work with criminal elements from society in order to mobilize forms of repressive governance that often contradict the hegemonic modes of rule and the rule of law, and in fact, traffic in illegal practices. In that regard, it's important to note that when fascism rose up in Italy, there's a lot of really interesting journalistic work that was being done in the United States that said that, well, what the black shirts are to Italy, the KKK is to the United States. It's just their version of the KKK. And so the United States, we should recognize, has a longstanding history of using parastate forms of governance to target the racialized working class in order to repress them by any means necessary. And that those forms of governance need to be understood as part of the overall structures of capitalist governance. The multiple modes of governance model then allows us to better understand why it is that liberals would be so tolerant of fascists, why it is that they insist that there's an absolute principle of free speech that needs to be preserved in the case of fascists, but can often be thrown under the bus when it comes to socialists or communists, because these are the people who are beyond the pale. We also know that with the January 6th hearings, the US government has treated the fascist organizations that were involved in this, as well as the leaders, with kid gloves, instead of being immediately thrown in prison, as they would have been if they were members of the racialized working class in this country, or if they were trying to storm the government in order to set up a socialist form of government. They have been treated with the utmost form of liberal tolerance, which then begs the question of the extent to which, and I alluded to this earlier, but I'll just sum this part of the talk up very quickly. I think that if we see fascism and liberalism as two modes of governance within capitalism, the liberal mode of governance tends to be used as a kind of good cop for those sectors of the population that can be ruled hegemonically because they are willing to acquiesce. So the basic deal is, if you stay in your lane, don't get too organized, don't try to overthrow the system, don't try to overeducate people, then you can vote for a capitalist candidate that we choose for you. You can have certain minimal rights as established by the Bill of Rights because we'll keep basic kind of structures of legality in place. That form of hegemonic rule mainly targets the middle and upper middle classes, the professional managerial class stratum, and that is how it tends to operate. Another mode of governance, though, has been operative throughout the history of the United States and other capitalist countries, and that is a mode of governance that is used against the colonized populations, the neo-colonized populations, the racialized populations, the immigrant populations, et cetera. That mode of governance tends to be the bad cop of capitalism, in which the rule of law is out the window, respect for fundamental rights disappears, there is no right to vote or other such things. Instead, it is reliance on repressive violence that often takes two different forms. It's either the direct repressive violence of the state through ICE and through the police and the FBI and things like this, or the various vigilante organizations that the bourgeois state works very, very closely with. These can be the Klan, these can be the Three Percenters, and the other organizations that I was alluding to earlier, but they work hand in glove with one another in order to exercise this mode of fascist or fascistic governance, whatever term you prefer, in order to keep that population down. Now, there is a difference between a bourgeois form of rule that has liberal governance for the middle and upper middle classes and fascist governance for the more insurgent forms of the racialized underclass. That said, this is quite different than if the hegemonic mode of governance goes full on authoritarian and full on fascist, right? So I think that we need to have different levels of analysis. And as I mentioned earlier, not just go down a kind of ultra leftist position that says, well, liberalism and fascism are the same thing. No, we should fight for the rule of law. The more rule of law that we can have, the better it is for building power, organizing, keeping our people safe, et cetera. There are at least two or three elements I want to touch on. One is, and I've detailed this in a very long article that I wrote for Counterpunch, I think that the January 6th event needs to be understood as an inside affair that was overseen by elements of the U.S. government, the military, and the U.S. national security state, and that this was not a grassroots movement from below. It was astroturfed from above by members of the capitalist ruling class, in particular someone like Anna Massouglia, who dedicated some, I think it was $4.3 million to the January 6th organizers and other elements of the extreme right-wing capitalist backers of these movements. Of course, Donald Trump played a very strong role in this. And what's remarkable is if you look through the history of the organizations who were involved in the January 6th storming of the Capitol, they have very, very strong ties to the military and to the bourgeois state in various ways. If I can find it, I'm just scrolling through some of my notes. There's a really interesting set of analyses put forth by a former FBI agent. I'm not finding it right now, but I can find it if somebody wants it, who basically says, you know, the leaders of these movements, these fascists, we know them because we've been working with them for years, right? This is a member of the FBI. I think his name is Mike German, who's saying this. And so it's not just that these were kind of fascist outsiders. They were fascists who were astroturfed and backed by the capitalist ruling class, the most reactionary elements of it, and certain elements of the bourgeois state that opened up the gates to power and let them in. And I think we have to see all of that together. The other two examples, again, I'll touch on as a kind of form of provocation for the discussion, is the case of Ukraine and the case of Palestine. In the case of Ukraine, if you have a bourgeois concept of fascism and you reduce fascism to a culturalist undertaking, then you can easily collapse it into something like cultural anti-Semitism. and fall into the trap of saying, well, Zelensky has Jewish heritage, therefore Ukraine couldn't be fascist. Or Israel as a self-proclaimed Jewish state couldn't somehow be fascist, because fascism and anti-Semitism somehow go together, because fascism is understood in a culturalist form as hating or targeting just one specific group of people. As I mentioned earlier, I think this is an incorrect approach to fascism. Fascism needs to be understood in terms of the economic base and what's driving it, and the ideologies that it mobilizes will differ based on the target populations. And so in the case of Ukraine, it seems the overall framework of what's going on in Ukraine is that you had a Russian separatist movement in the East, which had historically been the bastion for the industrial working class and the communists, that since 2014, when there was a US-backed fascist coup d'etat in Ukraine against a democratically elected leader, that region said, we don't want to be under fascist rule, we want independence. And some, I believe, 14,000 people approximately were killed between 2014 and the onset of the special military operation on the part of the Russians. And the way that Ukraine was fighting a lot of these separatist movements in the East was by the Azov battalion, Adar battalion, other battalions that are extreme right-wing fascist battalions who are backed by the capitalist ruling class in Ukraine, in particular Kolomyosky, who happens to be, I think he was, the last time I checked, he's the third richest oligarch in Ukraine, backed not only Azov, but other battalions that were later integrated into, Azov was integrated into the Ukrainian National Guard. He also was one of the principal supporters for Zelensky's presidential run, and he was invested in the television platform that ran the show where Zelensky was, as an actor, playing the president of Ukraine that he would later become. So much so that many people now see that TV show as basically a long advertisement campaign for his run for office. So you have the same capitalist power interested in funding fascist militias and funding the government that, granted, Zelensky's political platform isn't explicitly fascist in the sense of the extreme right-wing parties that also are operative within Ukraine, and the control of the parliament of those parties is minimal. But if you look at what has happened in Ukraine since the special military intervention in the East, what you have is a totalitarian state that has shut down alternative media, canceled and banned opposition parties, thrown socialist and communist leaders into prison, and is involved in a kind of draconian police state that has now punted elections. And so elections are being pushed back further and further. And in that regard, I think that we have to be able to see that, yes, there are very strong cultural fascist elements and militias that have been integrated into the National Guard operative within Ukraine, and undertake a dialectical, variegated analysis in which you look at the different fascistic elements, and there are some semblance of elements of a kind of parliamentary democracy, if you will, but there's no longer any elections, there aren't opposition parties, there's no opposition press. So it's been completely gutted. Moreover, Ukraine has become one of the centers of international organizing of fascists, and it has been that for quite some time. The CIA has been working for 70 years in Ukraine, running assets first against the Soviet Union, now against Russia, of course. And so I think all of that has to be factored in to understanding what's going on in that case. I'll just say very briefly regarding the situation in Palestine that if you have a culturalist bourgeois understanding of fascism, then it prohibits you from being able to see a fascism that would be mobilized by a self-declared Jewish state. However, if you bracket that and you instead take a historical materialist and dialectical analysis, looking at the economic base and the deep history of Israel, then you have to recognize that what we're dealing with, according to the Zionists themselves, is a colonial project backed by the major imperialist Western powers, of course, Britain taking an important role early on, the US taking that over a bit later. And one of the principal goals of that longstanding colonial, settler colonial imperialist project is to take over land, natural resources, proletarianize the extant population of these regions, and also have a beachhead in an area of the world known, of course, for its extremely important natural resources, oil and gas being the first and foremost among them. And so within that much larger context, then Israel can be recognized for what it is, and that is an imperialist-backed settler colony that is quite clear about what it is that it's doing. Its political leaders have said it time and time again. We now have the most recent ICJ ruling that doesn't quite yet go all the way, but at least says that there's ample evidence to investigate Israel for undertaking a genocide with imperialist backing. But the target of that genocide is the Palestinian people. And they are the ones who are being racialized and targeted for elimination. And we're now at a level that far surpasses the Nakba of 1948. And of course, the Nakba has been ongoing. It's been an endless catastrophe. But if you just look at the numbers in 1948 and you compare them to the numbers today, they're double or triple that, depending on what sources you look at, et cetera. So in that regard, I think that the historical materialist and dialectical approach to fascism is absolutely essential for understanding the contemporary world, because then we can see that fascism also operates as the cutting edge of imperialism. When you need to dispossess people, beat back alternative threats, and make sure you impose capitalist relations by any means necessary, right there at that cutting edge of imperialism, where NATO's pushing to the east in the case of Ukraine, where the Israeli army is dispossessing and pushing out the Palestinians in order to take over all of Gaza, at least that's certainly what it's looking like now, and make it into, just incorporate it into Israel, and the same similar things are going on in the West Bank, then what you have are two imperialist endeavors that can, and I think should, be conceptually framed in terms of the history of how fascistic modes of violence are operative in the history of capitalist-driven colonialism.